Radio 4, David Aronovich and a panel of expert guests will be discussing the state of the UK economy and exploring whether it's as gloomy as the government is warning. That's in the briefing room tomorrow afternoon, just after 4. And in-depth political discussion returns this weekend.
I was definitely too young when I was leader of the opposition, and not to do many of the other jobs I did in government.
Admissions and insights from the people who shape how we think.
I would say my family, well, gave myself and my two siblings a critical eye.
And because it's not just politicians who mould our lives, we also hear from economists, comedians and best-selling authors.
It's the fastest way to change things. You do need politics, but if you want to change something overnight, culture is the quickest way to do it.
Conversations, not newsy interrogations. The new series of Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Saturday evening at 5:30.
Probing questions of a very different kind now, and ahead of a new series of Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz, starting in October, is the very first episode, which was recorded in 2022. And this week's theme is literature. So pencils at the ready, and do please turn your phone off.
Geography and history and music, films and telly. Everyone who's ever lived from Taylor Swift to Botticelli. What a fun-packed evening this is. Welcome to Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz.
I mean, good evening. Thanks for the applause. And hopefully, like me, you're excited that this is the first ever episode of a brand new radio show. Yeah, that sort of excitement. It's called Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz. Will this show be a long-running success? Like Doctor Who, still going strong after 59 years, its loyal fan base unswerving in their support, despite the controversial casting decision of 2017 to introduce Bradley Walsh as a Cockney bus driver from Sheffield. Or will it be like Hardwick House, the infamous 1987 ITV sitcom that was cancelled after just 2 episodes? Set in a fictional comprehensive school, its relentless barrage of tasteless jokes broke so many taboos that the show was never seen again. Although many of the jokes re-emerged in the 2021 Netflix special by Jimmy Carr. Whether the show is a success or not is partly down to you, as we work together to create the perfect pub quiz. If you don't know what a pub quiz is, it is as British as roast beef, strawberries and cream, several refreshing beers, all enjoyed with a large group of friends while the rest of the country are obeying the lockdown regulations that you yourself put in place. If you genuinely don't know, a pub quiz is a night out where teams try and answer as many questions as possible to win a prize. A prize that can range from genuinely useful, cash, to absolutely useless, a bar tab for next week's quiz, when you live 200 miles away and on holiday. The size of the team can vary between 1 to 101. There appears to be no hard and fast rules on this, and many is the time that a member of a victorious 20-strong team will walk up to someone sat there on their own and say, "Take that, loser. You're meant to be a chaser." But you can't even beat our team. You're only the fourth best on the show anyway. Oh, by the way, can you record a message on my phone saying hello to my gran? She thinks you're great. So many memories. There are 3 things common to most pub quizzes. Number 1, that the question master will not consider the possibility that his answer might be wrong. Number 2, some familiarity there. Got an angry audience in tonight, I like it. An angry, bitter audience. Number 2, that at least 3 people over the course of the evening will be seen paying a visit to a toilet, and on their return will be able to recite the months of the French Revolutionary calendar in miraculous order. Either the process of emptying a bladder opens up a remarkably large number of neural pathways, or these people are cheats who must die. So difficult to know which one it is. And number 3, the questions, with respect, could be better. And that is where this show comes in. It is my opinion that a good pub quiz should be about more than telling you what you already know. I mean, I'm now banned from taking part in pub quizzes. Understandable, really, given my long track record of selling illegal DVDs. You've got to get your comedy out there somehow. But I write and host a lot of pub quizzes. And the number of happy customers grateful that they've learned something new is sometimes in double figures. You might be surprised to know that I usually start a pub quiz with an anagram. The reason is it gets everyone chatting and every team works it out by the end. So before we move on to actual general knowledge, your first question, audience of the evening, is A Grim Person is an anagram of which noted celebrity? There's a clue in the words.
Piers Morgan,
over there. Well done, madam. Congratulations there, fast thinking. The answer is Piers Morgan. In fact, the answer to nearly all of my quiz anagrams is Piers Morgan. It's not just that I feel that after several decades in the media, it's nice for him to be useful for once. It's also that no other celebrity has a name that lends itself so well to anagrams. 95% of the words first chosen by people on Wordle can be found within the letters of Piers Morgan. That fact is made up, but you can't prove it's wrong. Because Piers Morgan is not just a grim person. He has a grim persona. Genius, two very different anagrams. He is undoubtedly a smearing pro, a romping ass, who induces absolutely nobody to ripen orgasm. Not even Mr. Singapore. I wonder if one day he'll rise to the role of PM organiser. Although none of these anagrams is as insulting as Morgan Piers. Our theme for this week's show is literature. My main problem with literature and pub quizzes is that most quiz setters' idea of literature is Harry Potter. This evening there will be no questions on Harry Potter. This is not just because I've never read a Harry Potter novel. It is also that I feel uncomfortable about writing questions on the subject, given what we now know about J.K. Rowling. That over a number of years, she wrote a series of tedious novels about wizards. Though I do like the fact that my refusal to read her books used to make me look like a reactionary, joyless granddad, and now makes me look like an ultra-woke trans ally. And all I had to do was nothing. Very much my kind of activism. But there's also the fact that whilst Rowling's books are undoubtedly globally popular, nobody ever asks questions about the writer who is actually the world's best-selling living novelist. Anyone? Carlin? Did someone say Barbara Carlin? Yeah. I've got some very bad news for you. James Patterson's a good guess. Jacqueline Wilson's a good guess. Dick Francis, I've got some very bad news for you as well. Hilary Mantel, Lee Child, we've got a lot of Brit. Well, no one's got it yet. The answer is not J.K. Rowling. J.R. Harley, no. We are very much blurring the barrier between fact and fiction here.
Dan Brown?
No, it's not Dan Brown. Let me tell you, because the answer's not J.K. Rowling, and it's not even Dr. Adam Kay, whom I used to know quite well before he went to live in his castle made of gold. It's not the current Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, Nadine Dorries, who in the last decade has created several works of barely credible fiction, as well as many books. The answer is Danielle Steele. Only three writers of fiction have ever sold more books than Danielle Steele. And please say they're all British, and what's more, they're all three make us proud to be British. They are William Shakespeare, Agatha Christie, and a former Hertfordshire councillor for the Conservative Party who campaigned successfully for nursing home reform, improvements of the salaries of midwives, and the legalisation of educating Romany children. That author was, in fact, Barbara Cartland. You missed your chance there, sir. You didn't know what she did, and you didn't know whether she was dead or alive. It's not been a good evening for you so far. But fourth in the list is Danielle Steele. Perhaps the reason nobody asks questions about Danielle Steele is she's done a remarkably good job of keeping herself to herself. I mean, obviously, we all know her novels. There's the one where the troubled rich woman enters a troubled relationship with a troubled rich gentleman. And the other ones, where a troubled rich gentleman exits a troubled relationship with a troubled rich woman. All we know about her is she owns 6,000 pairs of... anyone?
Shoes.
Specifically, Louboutin shoes. 6,000 pairs. Only one person in the world owns more pairs of Louboutins than Danielle Steele. And that is?
Louboutin.
Correct, Christian Louboutin. That's just how... glad to see some of you know how economics works. Now over to you. It's quid pro quo. Does anyone in the audience have any questions they'd like to propose? Hopefully, on this week's theme of literature.
Which were the first three Bond novels written by Ian Fleming? If you really want to be a show-off, you can tell you what the years were.
I resent the implication that a professional quizzer who's inveigled his way into Radio 4 commissioning a show about quiz could possibly be a show-off. I understand there's a trick to this somewhere. I mean, the first one was Casino Royale.
Correct.
The second one was Dr. No?
No.
No. Was it Thunderball?
No.
Oh, go on, what was it?
Second one was Live and Let Die. And third one was Moonraker.
Well done, you've got...
Assuming Wikipedia is correct.
Oh, right. Trust me, mate, if Wikipedia isn't correct, we've got a very long evening in front of us.
You probably asked this question, but in which year did J.K. Rowling publish Harry Potter and Philosopher's Stone?
I genuinely don't know it, but I do have a guess. Is it 1997?
Yeah.
Yay!
So, famous writer and cartoonist Tove Jansson is from which country?
Well, this one I do know. Oh. She's a... as an LGBT icon and gives her name to a famous children's award, she's Finnish.
Yes, she is.
She's the creator of the Moomins.
She is.
And you'll get your £20 after the show. Now back to me for your next question on literature. Which famous American author claimed that he owned two alphabetically organised filing cabinets? The first one labelled A to N.
Baum.
Well, that was quick. It was Baum. Or to give him his name, L. Frank Baum, because his second filing cabinet would be called O to Z. That's how he claims he got the idea for the novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which was turned into a film with the same name starring which actress as Dorothy? Wrong. I said film with the same name. The novel was called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, not The Wizard of Oz. The film with the same name, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, was a silent movie in 1910 in which Dorothy was played by B.B. Daniels. The Wizard of Oz is a totally different film, directed by Larry Seaman. And starring who as Dorothy?
Judy Garland.
Wrong. Larry Seaman directed the 1925 Wizard of Oz, starring his then-wife, Dorothy Dwan, in the lead role. Judy Garland played Dorothy Gale in the 1939 version, directed by Victor Fleming. That film was so legendarily popular amongst the gay community that the phrase friend of Dorothy came to be used as a euphemism for a gay man. It must be a generational thing. Amongst my generation, it's not friend of Dorothy, it's friend of Goose, that volleyball scene in Top Gun. I'll throw in an extra fact about L. Frank Baum. His mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, gives a name to something called the Matilda effect. Does anyone know what the Matilda effect is?
Yes, I do.
Go on, then.
When male scientists claim credit for a female scientist's discovery.
Very good answer from your husband there. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, back over to you. Anyone got a question?
Hello. Which much-loved work of literature was written as the result of a bet that the writer couldn't write a book using only 50 different words?
Sounds like it should be Dan Brown, but... I think it might be Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you very much.
sort of on a side issue to literature, what name is given to words such as bolt, cut, go and screen, which share the same quirky quality?
Are they verbs?
They are! They are, but these are specific kinds of verbs.
Short verbs?
They are!
Monosyllabic verbs?
They are! What about sanction? Does that help you?
Sanction?
What is unusual about the word sanction?
It's one letter out from being an anagram of cast iron.
No, I'm afraid not.
No, you'll have to explain it to me.
OK. Bolt, cut, go and screen are all contronyms or auto-anonyms.
Oh, that's very good.
I know it is. I'm a smart ass.
Please explain to the audience what a contronym is, though.
A contronym is a word that has meanings that are direct opposites. So, bolt means to run like hell, but also means to bolt something down, so it doesn't move at all. To cut means to cut into little pieces, but also means to add, because you cut drugs. I'm sure you don't know anything about that, of course.
You're quite right there. This is the BBC. We don't do that sort of thing.
No, sorry, I apologise. Please cut that. A screen, obviously, means you can...
Show something or
show
hide something.
Show something, broadcast it. Obviously, nowadays, you're reduced to radio, but... There we are.
I'm literally on television once a week, mate.
I've seen you there, yeah. Very good. Sometimes you get beaten as well.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have the job because I'd be deemed too boring.
Oh, no.
Not that that's any trouble for you, sir.
No. And go, obviously, something can go as you
It's an excellent fact. I misheard screen as scream, otherwise, I might have.
Screen, I beg your pardon. Screen.
No, when you said it, I misheard it as scream. I might have got it. It was a quiz where that fact came up last week, and I'm very, very annoyed.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
a really good fact about contronyms.
Anyway,
can I also add a helpful audience interaction?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you very much. Over to me for another literature question. Published posthumously in 1657, who wrote the novel The Other World, a comical history of the states and empires of the moon? There are two reasons why I'm asking this question. Number one, it is considered one of the earliest science fiction novels, with Arthur C. Clarke crediting it with the first ever description of rocket-powered spaceflight. And number two, despite the importance of this novel, it is nowhere near what we know this person for. Thomas Moore?
H.G. Wells.
No, 1657. A bit early for Swift.
Daniel Defoe.
Daniel Defoe. It's a bit early for Daniel Defoe as well. 1657 and posthumously. The novel is narrated in the first person by a character explaining his various attempts to fly to the moon. Eventually, after several failures, he accidentally gets fired to the moon, whose inhabitants have four legs and musical voices and own a weapon that can simultaneously shoot and cook animals. I'll be honest, if I had four legs, a musical voice and a weapon that could kill and cook an animal simultaneously, I would never leave the house. The narrator shares his name with the author, Serrano. The author is Serrano de Bergerac. You know, old big nose. It's not that well known that Serrano de Bergerac was for real. We know him best thanks to an 1897 play by Edmund Rostand that was adapted into films starring Gerard Depardieu, Steve Martin, and most recently, Peter Dinklage, although the definitive performance was by John Nettles in a 1980s TV series. The real-life Serrano de Bergerac was not only a science fiction novelist, but a playwright, epistolarian, and a dualist. That's four great talents. That's five more than Toby Young. And despite these life achievements, the romantic plot lines of the play and films are entirely fictional. And actually, Serrano de Bergerac was probably gay. The clue is he had a relationship with the writer and musician Charles Coipeau de Soucy. They were both blokes. It ended acrimoniously with the men sending each other death threats and then something far, far worse, satirical essays. I think it's fair to say that we all have a very different idea of what satire is, so I must stress, this is mid-17th century French lovers' tiff satire. Serrano de Bergerac's spurned lover wrote a pamphlet with the amazing title The Battle of Cyrano de Bergerac with the monkey from Brioche's place to the end of the Pont Neuf. This might be the most French thing that any Frenchman has literally done. Before we move on to my last question, over to the audience for your last question.
The Hotel Monteleone in New Orleans, there are some very famous authors connected with it. Can you name any of them?
The Hotel
Monteleone in New Orleans.
When you say connected, just that they stayed there?
One in particular insisted he was born there. That's not true, but he insisted he was born there.
Well, go with something. You've got a lot of confidence to contradict his account of his own birth.
Oh, no. It is stated that his mother was pregnant and living there at the time.
Someone's done their research.
Yes.
Well, the only thing I know is that James Patterson stayed there for a while and left a very withering review on TripAdvisor. Right now, you can't prove that I'm wrong, so I'm sticking with it. But what is the? I ought to guess something, really. So I'm going to guess Mark Twain.
No, Truman Capote always insisted he was born there.
Ah.
And Tennessee Williams, and Ernest Hemingway are all connected. Yes.
That's very good. Yes, okay. They all just stayed there.
Yes. They actually lived there for quite a while.
Well, staying there is the same as living there temporarily.
So I suppose so.
Like Alan Partridge and the Linton Travelers. Thank you very much for this.
A literary masterpiece, but I'm just wondering if you know the name of the country in which Eric Morecambe's The Reluctant Vampire was set. And it's a really good book.
It's a really good question, but I've not read it.
He did too, called The Reluctant Vampire and The Vampire's Revenge.
Yeah, a bit of a one-trick pony, Morecambe, wasn't he? I'm going to go for Burkina Faso.
Oh, close.
Australia?
No, not
Mali,
really. Not really.
Cameroon? St. Kitts and Nevis. Venezuela. No. Kazakhstan.
Well, Vernon the Vampire, who is the lead character, lived in Catchem by the Throat in the land of Gotcha. Read the books, very good.
I'll choose not to. Your last question of the evening. What links the very famous poem Ozymandias with the very famous novel Frankenstein? Shelley is correct. Of course it is correct. Allow me to explain that they were both written by people called Shelley, and that's the least interesting of the three major things they have in common. Yes, they were written by a husband and wife, Percy Shelley and Mary Shelley, very much the Jay-Z and Beyonce of their time. The second major thing they have in common is they were actually published in the same month. Frankenstein on January the 1st, 1818, and Ozymandias on January the 11th, 1818. But the third major thing they have in common is both works were produced as a result of a competition between friends. In the lesser known of these instances, Percy Shelley and his friend, the poet Horace Smith, decided they would each write a poem on the same subject and submit their work to the literary magazine The Examiner, both under pseudonyms. But what subject were they going to produce a poem on? I imagine the conversation went, "Do you know what? I heard a very funny story about a man in Nantucket." To which the other replied, "No, mate, it's been done. Let's do the Egyptian pharaoh Ramesses II. Shelley's poem is famous for the line, "My name is Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Horace Smith's effort in comparison was pitiful. "I am great Ozymandias, saith a stone, king of kings. This mighty city shows the wonders of my hand." So different. And yet we barely need to ask who won this particular competition. Shelley's effort has pride of place in every English language school syllabus across the globe, whereas Horace Smith's version received its biggest ever audience 30 seconds ago on Radio 4. The story of the creation of Frankenstein is more widely known, I suppose very widely known in here. In the summer of 1816, the Shelleys decamped to Switzerland to visit their good friend, Lord Byron, in his chateau, the Villa Diodati. I imagine at that time that a night in with Lord Byron was the equivalent of a night in with Frank Boff. I judge that reference on the age of the room. But the visit turned out to be longer than anticipated owing to what had happened in Indonesia the previous year. Can anyone tell me what happened in Indonesia? That's right. What happened was the largest known volcanic eruption in history. By Krakatoa, if you're ignorant, but actually by a volcano that never had the PR team that Krakatoa had. Mount Tambora. Mount Tambora was the largest known volcanic eruption in history, so ferocious that in 1816, the following year, the global climate was changed to such a degree that the following year was known as the Year Without a Summer in North America and Europe. But this is the BBC, so I must present, for balance, the alternative view outlined in the Doctor Who episode, The Haunting of Villa Diodati, which the meteorological changes were said to be caused by the interfering of the Cybermen. Although that episode is best remembered for Lord Byron, Percy Shelley and Mary Shelley meeting Graham, a Cockney bus driver from Sheffield. What happened was that Switzerland in 1816 had god-awful weather, and the housebound authors decided to challenge each other to a writing competition. While Percy Shelley was the loser, there was no doubt as to the name of the victor. Frankenstein. Oh, grow up. At the age of 20, Mary Shelley published one of the most sophisticated and influential works of English language fiction of all time. But what of Byron? Perhaps distracted by his relentless lifestyle of opioids and bonking, the best he could muster was some half-hearted anecdotes about mythological creatures he'd heard about whilst touring Eastern Europe a few years previously. Luckily for Byron, his friend, John Polidori, had enough interest in his anecdotes to basically claim them as his own and publish them as a short work of prose fiction in 1819. Can anyone tell me the name of the work?
Harry Potter.
I think somebody got it. It was actually called The Vampire. It was the first ever work of the all-conquering genre of Western vampire literature. From Buffy, to What We Do in the Shadows, to Count Dracula, to Eric Morecambe's entire literary career. It all started because a group of friends had to stay inside for a few days because of an Indonesian volcanic eruption the previous year. 2 years of lockdown, and all I managed to do was learn to hula hoop and binge watch Hardwick House. So I hope you've enjoyed our pub quiz questions for this episode. We have learned that Mr. Singapore is an anagram of Piers Morgan. We have learned what a contronym is. We have learned that Truman Capote lied about his place of birth. We have learned that sometimes authors stay in hotels. And most importantly of all, we know that Eric Morecambe is a man of even more talents than we'd ever imagined previously. And the fact that if history had taken a slightly different turn, there might have been a very famous film called The Wizard of Anne. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining in. Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz was presented and written by me, Paul Sinha, with additional material by Oliver Levy and additional questions by the audience. The producer was Ed Morrish, and it was a Lead Mojo production for BBC Radio 4.
And Paul will be back next week with an episode themed around geography. The news is next after a word about Friday night's comedy here on Radio 4.
Hello, I'm Andy Zaltzman, just back from a trip to the future in the BBC's one remaining functioning time machine. Ahead of the new series of the News Quiz, I've been checking out how the news from now will be looked back on by the world in 100 years' time.
What on earth are you people doing?
Sorry, I think someone might have hitched a ride back. Anyway, they're a bit cross.
Honestly, what are you all thinking?
To find out why our future friends are not 100% in love with us, tune in over the next few weeks to the News Quiz. Friday night's 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.